It's 200 years since the death of that great Wangal leader and ambassador to the Sydney colony, Bennelong. Bennelong has long been cast as a tragic figure, a damaged character from countless Australian histories and novels and narratives. But as more information about him and his contemporaries comes to light, Bennelong is being recast as an adventurer, a politician, a diplomat, and it seems he's still speaking to us across the centuries in words and song. Historian and curator Keith Vincent Smith has been investigating Bennelong's life and his long, traumatic voyage to Britain in 1792. Back at the Governor's house in Sydney Cove, Bennelong wrote a letter to Lord Sydney. We're not sure if Bennelong dictated it to another person or wrote it in his own hand because the original letter can't be found. Only a copy survives. Smith found the copy of the letter we have today in an obscure German astronomy journal published at the start of the 1800s. And so here it is, Bennelong speaking to us across the centuries.
Sir, I am very well. I hope you are very well. I live at the Governor's. I have everyday dinner there. I have not my wife. Another black man took her away. We have had Murray doings. He speared me in the back. But I better now. His name is Garraway. All my friends alive and well. Not me. Go to England no more. I am home now. I hope, sir, you send me anything you please. Hope all well in England. I hope Mrs. Philip very well. You nurse me, madam, when I'm sick. You're very good, madam. Thank you, madam. And hope you remember me, madam, not forget.
John Hunter took the letter. He talked to Banks. Banks sent the letter to Göttingen, where Blumenbach, the anatomist, the man who coined the word Caucasian, lived, and he sent it on to the astronomer, who published the letter then in his monthly journal, which was a kind of magazine that plotted the stars and gave readings of for various ports around the world. So very valuable piece of publication in those days.
What was the context for the publication in this German journal?
Don't know. It's quite different than most of the things in the journal. It has had reports previously of Cook going to Botany Bay, that you know, voyages in general, and telling the coordinates of those ports. So I guess that's the sort of context of it. But it was a curiosity, I would say. Blumenbach had been sent heads of Port Jackson men, probably won by Philip and probably won by Hunter.
Madam, I want stockings. Thank you, madam. Send me 2 pair stockings. Sir, you give my duty to Lord Sydney. Thank you. Very good, my lord. Hope very well, all family. Sir, please send me some handkerchiefs for pocket. You please, sir. You send me some shoes? 2 pair. You please, sir. Bennelong, 1796.
Bennelong had seen and sat with Philip when he wrote letters, and Philip would write letters and say, you know, I'd like 200 pairs of trousers and, you know, 400 stockings, and Bennelong had seen these arrive by ship months later. So he was in the reciprocal exchange is legendary in Aboriginal society, and he thought that if he wrote a letter, these things would be sent to him. Well, and they might have been also.
Lots of historians have interpreted Bennelong's mood and his personality from that letter, which is difficult given that it is quite brief and that it has a quite specific purpose. But what can it tell us about him?
Well, his character completely. It's a two-sided letter. It's seeking goods and at the same time politely thanking people.
Bennelong is full of contradictions. He survived smallpox and frontier violence, and his first personal encounter with Europeans came when he was kidnapped by them in 1789. But he spent more than half his life in their company. Governor Phillip had been ordered by the king to conciliate the affections of the natives and live in kindness with them. But, perhaps terrified of smallpox, no local people would come near the Sydney settlement. So the governor gave an order to bring some in by force. Bennelong and his elder, Colby, were fishing with their Wongal and Gadigal clans at Manly Cove when a party of redcoats, led by Lieutenant William Bradley, made the attack.
They were dancing together when the signal was given by me, and the two poor devils were seized and handed into the boat in an instant. The natives, who were very numerous all round, on seeing us seize those two, immediately advanced with their spears and clubs, but we were too quick for them. The noise of the men, women and children, together with the situation of the two miserable wretches in our possession, was really a most distressing scene. They were much terrified, one of them particularly so. On our landing at Sydney Cove, we were met by Nan Barry, the native boy, much pleased, and he called them by name, Colby and Bennelong. They were taken to the governor's house, where they were soon met by Arabu, the native girl. She called them by name, the same as the boy had done, and she was quite frantic with joy. They were assured that they would be well treated, but all that could be said or done was not sufficient to remove the pang which they naturally felt at being torn away from their friends, or to reconcile them to their situation. It gave me great satisfaction to find that neither of them had wife or family who would feel their loss or be distressed by their being taken away. It was by far the most unpleasant service I was ever ordered to execute. Lieutenant William Bradley, Sydney Cove, 1789.
Yeah, this is Philip's diplomacy, because he has orders from George III to live in peace and amity with the indigenous people. Nobody had come in since February 1788, when he captured Arabanu not long after. But Arabanu, a man also captured at Manly Cove, died of smallpox in May that year, unfortunately. But hadn't been able to give them very much information. In Bennelong, they had a lucky choice.
We soon discovered that one was a chief, or distinguished person, among those of the tribe of Cadigal. His name was Colby. He was a man of about 35 years of age. The other was about 25 years old, and was called by several different names, such as Bennelong, Voldratuye, or Volaraveri. This man was a very good-looking young fellow, of a pleasant, lively disposition. Captain John Hunter, 1789.
Colby quickly got away, chewed through his ropes, and his keeper was given a few lashes in return for that. But Bennelong made friends with Philip. 3 months after Bennelong had been captured, Philip told Lord Sydney in London by letter, these were the clans and the dispositions in the immediate Port Jackson area. All the information from Bennelong, who's happy to give it.
But how do they communicate? I mean, Bennelong, within a three-month period, had obviously learned
clever man, he'd learned enough English, yes.
His powers of mind were certainly far above mediocrity. He acquired knowledge, both of our manners and language, faster than his predecessor had done. He willingly communicated information, sang, danced, and capered. He told us all the customs of his country and all the details of his family economy. Love and war seemed his favourite pursuits, in both of which he had suffered severely. Watkin Tench, 1790.
After a few months at the governor's house, Bennelong, like Colby, ran away. Interestingly, about 6 months later, he returned of his own volition. But why? Keith Vincent Smith thinks he'd been sent back to try and smooth out diplomatic relations with the Europeans.
Well, he sits as a powerful person who was working very cleverly, first of all, to gain material goods. He got iron hatchets, which he traded down to other people. He was given, you know, metal fishing spears, lots of advantages, clothing, food, when he wanted it, for him and his people. And he was looking after them, really, by making what really is an unwritten treaty with Philip, coming in peacefully. 14 people had been speared up till that time for about 2 years, till Bennelong boarded the HMS Atlantic with Governor Philip and his companion Yamarawani in November 1792 to go to England. There was peace. There was no people being killed.
Bennelong and his people had decided to collaborate with the colony. There were benefits for him, his family, and the Sydney clans. He tried to build a relationship with Governor Philip based on kinship and mutual obligation. Watkin Tench observed the two men.
Although I call him only Bennelong, he has besides several appellations, and for a while he chose to be distinguished by that of Wallarawari. As a mark of affection and respect to the governor, Bennelong conferred on him the name Wallarawari, and sometimes called him Bean Enna, meaning father, adopting to himself the name of governor. This interchange of names, we found, is a constant symbol of friendship among them. Watkin Tench, 1790.
What was the context, I guess, for his decision to go back? I mean, given you mentioned before that Aribanu died of smallpox, that would have, and many hundreds of Aboriginal people died of smallpox.
Half by his account, half the Aboriginal people, which Philip had only estimated as 1,500 people on the coast, so he left with about 800 people. And the Cadigal, Gollaby and his people were just three people left out of what might have been a clan of 50 to 60 men, women and children in 1788. I can't think for Bennelong, but I can walk with him from what I've read, I suppose. He was after his own advancement. He was intrigued by this colonial life, and it did end up in him, you know, going to Britain and living in a Georgian townhouse in Mayfair, among other things.
With the governor, there embarked, voluntarily and cheerfully, two natives of this country, Bennelong and Yamarawani, two men who were much attached to his person, and who withstood, at the moment of their departure, the united distress of their wives and the dismal lamentations of their friends, to accompany him to England, a place they knew well was a great distance from them. David Collins, 1792.
Eora called the foreign settlers men from the clouds, Birra Wolgal. And there's a little paragraph in Dawes where he calls England Englander. So he just knew, for all he knew, it might have been in the stars, but he knew it was a long way away.
The journey took 8 months, sailing via Cape Horn and Rio. The two men might as well have been travelling to the moon. When their ship landed in Cornwall, they went by carriage to London, but there was no great excitement about their arrival. A couple of newspaper reports, that's it.
Nobody was there to greet them, but on the 24th of May 1793, the day they arrived, they were already outfitted with breeches and ruffled shirts and spotted waistcoats and buckled shoes and topcoats in the Regency fashion. So they were well looked after. They bought their hats from Busby's in the Strand. And later on they had... All this is in Treasury bills, and you can trace the expenses for their outings and carriages, visits to the theatre, washing and servants who attended them at the house of William Waterhouse in Mayfair near Berkeley Square.
Two sooty natives of New South Wales, brought over by Governor Philip, were introduced to several persons of consequence. They do not by any means correspond with the description we at first received of our Antipodes. For, instead of that vacuity of intellect and barrenness of observation which we were led to expect of them, one in particular displays much shrewdness and curiosity. A very merry fellow. He says he regrets nothing so much as the inconvenience he finds in the absence of his three wives, for whom he had not yet been able to find a substitute in this country.
Bennelong and Yemarawani went to the theatre, appeared in Parliament, visited museums and churches. But the punishing cold and damp of London made them both sick. Yemarawani was deathly ill with a chest infection when the London Observer reported,
"The two natives of New South Wales, at present in this metropolis, are in appearance scarcely human. They continue to reside in Mount Street, Berkeley Square, in the neighbourhood of which they are to be seen daily. They cannot walk without the support of sticks, and appear to have lost all that agility they are said formerly to have possessed."
According to Captain John Hunter, Bennelong was stricken with grief over the death of young Yemarawani and deeply distressed at having to bury him in England. Bennelong himself was gravely ill when he asked for passage home in 1794. He boarded the Reliance, growing sicker by the day, but the ship sat in port for several months before finally sailing in 1795.
"The surviving man is with me, but I think in a precarious state of health. He has for the past 12 months been flattered with the hope of seeing again his native country, a happiness which he has fondly looked forward to. But so long a disappointment has much broken his spirit, and the coldness of the weather here has so frequently laid him up that I am apprehensive his lungs are affected. That was the cause of the other's death. I do all I can to keep him up, but I'm still doubtful of his living. Captain John Hunter, to the Under Secretary of the Home Office, 1795.
He boarded the ship in July at Chatham. This ship did not leave till November. Of the 3.5 years he was away, 18 months were at sea on ships or in docks. And he began to be very ill, and Captain John Hunter, who was returning as governor, wrote a letter saying he feared he might die. But fortunately, George Bass and Matthew Flinders were aboard, and George Bass was a surgeon. He treated Bennelong. In return, Bennelong gave them all lessons in the English, in the Sydney language. And Flinders and Bass were saved by that when they met Botany Bay men and they were being threatened by others down in the Illawarra years later. And he gave to Daniel Payne, the master shipbuilder, who had on board the ship the first Tom Thumb, a nice long vocabulary also that we can read today.
Back home, Bennelong returned to his own people. The newspaper reports of the time lamented his decision.
"For some time after his return, it is true, he assumed the manners, the dress, and the consequence of a European, and treated his countrymen with a distance which evinced the sense he entertained of his own increased importance. So much pains had been taken for his improvement, both when he separated from his countrymen and since his return to New South Wales. But he has subsequently taken to the woods again, returned to his old habits, and now lives in the same manner as those who have never mixed with the civilised world."
The papers put it down to his inability to be civilised, not the traumatic nature of his journey or his desire to be among his own family again. Keith Vincent Smith also thinks Sydney had changed too much for Bennelong's taste.
And Hunter was now the governor, but he didn't have that same strength of friendship with Captain Hunter. We would take his clothes off every couple of weeks and he'd go into the bush. And people wrote letters to Lord Sydney and said, you know, Bennelong has returned to his old ways, and he would soon probably go back to the bush. And that's what he did. He constantly came into Sydney or Parramatta, but gravitated towards the Ryde area, Kissing Point as it was called, now modern Putney, a suburb of Sydney, where a group of people were seen by Holt, the Irish rebel, and he described 100 people coming in for breakfast with him, and he said Bennelong is the chief, and he would ask, tell these people to behave, otherwise it would be Murray Tat-Tat, which means he'd kill them, and then he would send his wives to get Mogra, so that's fish. It's obvious Bennelong was leading and still respected by his people, a clan of 100 people.
But had clearly chosen to abandon white society, or yes, had chosen to just come and visit from time to time.
Conveniently then, he settled at James Squire's Orchard, and this was the brewer, who was a friendly man at Kissing Point. And there's a reason for that, is that he's a gypsy extract. His parents were involved in a big case in which a girl was abducted in London several years before he was transported here, and gypsy people have oral history, gypsy people have totems, and like the fir tree, etc., for their clans. They have personal totem names also, so there's a lot in common. And I believe that's why Squires was sympathetic to Bennelong.
Bennelong died on Sunday morning last at Kissing Point. Of this veteran champion of the native tribe, little favourable can be said. His voyage to and benevolent treatment in Great Britain produced no change whatever in his manners and inclinations, which were naturally barbarous and ferocious. The principal officers of government had for many years endeavoured by the kindest of usage to wean him from his original habits and draw him into a relish for civilised life. But every effort was in vain exerted, and for the last few years he has been but little noticed. His propensity for drunkenness was inordinate, and when in that state he was insolent, menacing, and overbearing. In fact, he was a thorough savage, not to be warped from the form and character that nature gave him by all the efforts that mankind could use.
This is the most significant Aboriginal figure and perhaps the most understood Aboriginal person of that period, and he's part of our shared history, and whatever we know from those colonial times, he looms as a large figure in it.
He's often portrayed in history as having died broken-hearted, really.
Yeah, I don't think that's so. And as far as the steam goes, Nan Barry, a little Cadigal boy who was born in suffering from smallpox in 1789, asked to be buried in Bennelong's grave with him, and he was when he died in 1821. He'd become a great voyager also.
Just a small snippet of Bennelong and Yemarawani's song, discovered by Keith Vincent Smith and performed for the first time since 1792 at the State Library of New South Wales by Matthew Doyle and Clarence Slocke. The full program about Bennelong first aired on Hindsight in 2011.